Hi, I'm Mel Majeros. I am a four-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. Today we are talking to author, filmmaker, and cancer survivor, Michael Solomon. How are you today, Michael?
Hi, Mel. I'm fine. As you can tell, I'm in New York City. I heard your first siren.
Oh, I didn't hear that. That could be anywhere, actually. It could have been in Beirut, for all I know. So you wrote a book called Now It's Funny, How I Survived Cancer, Divorce, and Other Looming Disasters. But before we get into, you know, your how you were diagnosed and how you found out, I need to know, is that your ass on the cover?
That's the question I get asked the most about the book.
Really?
Yes, it really is.
And it is your ass?
Well, I suppose I should preface it with a drum roll. Oh. It's not.
Oh, so you need...
But it could be.
You needed a stunt butt?
It could be. You know, I certainly know the feeling of having your ass hanging out of a gown while people can see you. Mm-hmm. So I can certainly relate to the picture on the cover. But I thought maybe I should get somebody a little better looking from behind than me, so...
Oh. Well, that's unfortunate, because that could have been stories for your grandchildren right there. or a Christmas card. I'm just saying, you... Photoshop in a little Christmas hat or yarmulke, whatever. Go for the season that you want.
There you go. Maybe I just have to Photoshop it to look like me now.
Exactly.
Not sure what I would change. Maybe take a little bit of the hair off there the top go. Of his head is what I mean by that.
Well, okay. That's TMI, but okay. So, Michael, tell me how you found out you had cancer. What happened? How did that happen?
I found out by accident.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. When I turned 40... Or I should say, up until the years preceding when I turned 40, my father started to bother me saying, Mike, he calls me Mike. He said, Mike, you've got to get a colonoscopy when you turn 40. He told me this when I turned 36, 37, when I turned 38, when I turned 39. My dad has a real knack for always reminding me of these kind of things. And so when I turned 40, I said, I got to get a colonoscopy to a friend of mine who was a pediatrician. And he said, oh, I've got the perfect guy to send you to. He's a gastro and he's terrific. And he sent me to this doctor. His name is Michael Faust. And I got scared. I was like, Faust? What kind of is that for a doctor? Send me to Dr. Frankenstein while you're at it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I went to see Dr. Faust and he gave me a physical. And he said to me at the end, he said, I don't know what it is with you guys. You turn 40 and you think something's wrong with you. And I said, there's nothing wrong with me. It's just my father was, you know, very worried. There had been colon cancer in my family. My grandfather had died of colon cancer.
Okay.
And my aunt, who was his sister, had colon cancer as well. So he did have a reason to be concerned, although Dr. Faust told me the protocol is really for when you turn 50.
Oh.
But he said, anyway, I think that's the correct thing to do. I'm going to give you the colonoscopy. And then as I left his office, he said, oh, by the way, I want you to get a chest x-ray as well. And then... months passed.
Why did he want you to get a chest x-ray?
He didn't really say. He just said you should get a chest x-ray too.
Oh.
A couple months passed. I was terrified of getting a colonoscopy. I just, the whole idea of it scared me to death. I never really had that kind of medical testing before.
Because you have to drink that drink?
Well, you have to drink that drink and then you have this, you know, metallic intruder.
Yeah. danger, Will Robinson. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Did you get to keep the video? Because if you make a movie, well, we'll talk about later, you could have that as part of your,
no,
of the film.
It's good to know. I think I've retained the rights to it, though.
Excellent. Good.
Yes. Yes.
No one has bought the rights to your colonoscopy yet.
Not yet. But if any of your listeners are out there and want to make me an offer, I'll endeavor to get an agent and we can try to work something out.
Okay. So you were nervous about your colonoscopy, as everyone usually is.
Terrified.
Yes.
So a couple of months after I got the two prescriptions, one for the colonoscopy and one for the chest x-ray, I said to myself, oh, I know what I'll do. Something positive for my health. I'll get the chest x-ray, because I wasn't afraid of getting a chest x-ray.
Right.
So I picked up the prescription. I made an appointment. I went and I got the x-ray. And I thought, okay, that's it. And someday I'll get the colonoscopy. Well, a week after my chest x-ray, my phone rang at 9 o'clock at night. And on the caller ID, it says, Michael Faust.
That's never good.
Never good. So first I was like, should I answer the phone?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I'd better answer the phone. And Dr. Faust was great. He said to me, I know I'm calling you from home. Don't be alarmed. I'm just calling because I have your chest x-ray here with me at home. And at that point, I was like, okay. I thought to myself, it's over. He's about to tell me I'm dead. But he said, I'm just a little concerned because I think I see something on your left lung.
Oh.
Yeah. He said, I think it's what we call an old granuloma. And I wouldn't worry about it. I just want you to have it checked out. I want you to have a CAT scan, but don't worry about it. It's probably nothing.
Yeah.
The problem is when you say that to an ex-smoker like me, there may be something wrong with your lung. A wave of guilt washed over me.
Right.
And I thought, okay, I'm now about to pay for 20 years of smoking. Dr. Faust doesn't know that I smoked for 20 years, but you know, we may as well start to pick out a suit for me to be buried in. And I, with a great deal of trepidation, went in and had the CAT scan. 3 hours after the CAT scan, he called me. And I thought, what?
Yeah.
And his voice was trembling.
Ooh.
And said, Michael, I'm looking at your CAT scan. And the issue is this. And as soon as I heard him say, the issue is this.
Yeah, you know.
I never had an issue. He told me I didn't have an issue. What happened was there was nothing on my left lung. He thought he may have seen something. There was nothing there.
Oh.
But the CAT scan revealed that there was a mass on my right lung and that there was a mass on my liver.
That's crazy that it didn't show up on the x-ray.
Insane. Insane. He said, Michael, I've been looking at this x-ray for a week. I had it at home. Now I'm looking at it again. You just can't see anything. There's nothing. I don't see anything on your right lung in this x-ray. But the CAT scan indicates that it's there. And your liver, I can't understand that because I just did the blood work. There shouldn't be anything on your liver. So,
and you're like, yeah, you and me both, doc.
That's right. So he sent me for... first, he said, you're going to have to go to a lung specialist to figure out what's going on with your lung. And you're going to have to go get a sonogram to find out what's going on with your liver. And, of course, he happened to call me right when I was picking up my 6-year-old son. The thoughts that churned through my head,
right,
which are in the book, but which are also very vivid to me still today, are I can't lose this kid. My life can't end right now.
Right.
So I went to get the sonogram, which was hilarious because...
What does a sonogram do for a liver? I mean, is that kind of like an ultrasound?
It's exactly what it is. Okay. It's an ultrasound. It enables them to see what's there. But okay. It was me and 15 pregnant women.
It's like your cancer Lamaze class or something?
Right. That was the first sort of light moment that I had. I got in there and I said, this is ridiculous. I'm here and, you know, maybe... And I thought to myself... Wouldn't it be great if I was just pregnant? Maybe that, you know, I could be pregnant like all these other women.
Think of how rich you'd be right now. Instead of cancer, you could have
been. That's right. That's right. And I could make that movie. Oh, now Arnold Schwarzenegger made that movie already. But
well, you could make a good movie.
But. Right. So in the sonogram, there was a woman there and she said, there's nothing on your liver. I'm certain of it. I've done it 3 times. You've got cysts on your kidney. And I was like, oh, what fresh hell. Like now I've got kidney cancer. And she said, no. This is great news. We don't even treat cysts on the kidney. They're very benign. We leave them alone. You don't have anything to worry about, and you don't have liver cancer. So I thought, wow, if I could just go to the lung specialist and have him tell me, you know, maybe he saw something wrong, maybe he can give me a different test, I'm in the clear. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case.
Right.
I went to the lung specialist, and he confirmed that, in fact, what I had on my lung was a tumor.
Wow.
And that it was malignant.
How big was the tumor?
3 centimeters.
Ooh, that's a big one.
Yeah, and of course, I immediately started to look on the internet to see is it.
Oh,
is
don't
it,
ever do that.
Yes. And I quickly learned, you know, okay, if you ever look on the internet, you're definitely going to die because there's not really any reliable information there. So.
And you know, my doctor said, I mean, it's good to look on the internet for information, but not like. Give yourself at least like 3 days before you look on the internet. Because my doctor said, don't do it. Don't look on the internet. Don't try to get information. Just, you know, try to process this. And I was like, whatever. And I'm looking at all this stuff about my breast cancer. And I literally thought my head was just going to like spin around and shoot off.
And
And my fiance was like, didn't she tell you not to look? And I was like, Newman. Yeah, exactly. Don't do it. Don't. Yeah, just you know what, Dr. Google, Dr. WebMD, you're going to think all of a sudden you have malaria and every other disease known to man, and the worst case scenario is you, and that's not necessarily the case.
Right. I'd already done that when I thought I had the granuloma, and I was like, oh my God, I don't want to have one of these. So I stopped looking. That's the best advice you can give somebody. Avoid the internet at all costs.
Yes. Although find people you can talk to, but don't like have them give you like, oh yeah, my Aunt Sally had lung cancer and she died. It's like, oh.
Isn't it funny how nobody really knows what to say to anybody who has a cancer diagnosis unless they've had one before?
I know, exactly. Oh yeah, Susie had a horrible time. It's like, yeah, I don't want to hear about your Aunt Susie.
Right. They inevitably tell you about somebody who's died from whatever you have.
I actually had somebody, an old boss of mine, who saw me in, and I still remember it to this day, and every time I see her, I'm just like, oh my God. She's like, oh, I heard you had cancer. I'm just like, yes. Are you going to die? I'm like thinking, well, not right now or here in the parking lot of the grocery store. I hope not. I'm like, are you going to die? I'm like, yeah, the doctor didn't tell me I was, so, but yeah.
Right. But it's also, you know, on a deeper level, I think for me, it was really important to trust my doctors once I've decided I trusted them.
Yes. And that's very important too. If you don't trust your doctor, I always say find another doctor.
Right. Which I did too. I went and had a second opinion, and I actually switched doctors when it was time for me to have my first surgery, which I thought was it worked out well, fine. I think I thought it was the right thing to do. And certainly for me, it was the right thing to do. It's not necessarily for everyone, because sometimes the good news is you might find out something that you didn't know before. And the bad news is you have a very high possibility of more uncertainty.
Right. Now, did you have your lung removed?
I went in to have what I thought was going to be a third of my right lung removed. And my surgeon, who I think was absolutely brilliant, was able to remove only a small corner of my lung.
Oh, wow.
Through what she called a thoracotomy. They use a thoracoscopy. It's like an arthroscopy, but for your thorax, for your chest. Mm. And that's why I had chosen her as my surgeon. I'd gone to a surgeon before who I'm sure was an excellent surgeon, but he had never offered me that option.
Oh, yeah.
So I went for a second opinion, and she said, yeah, I'm going to just put three holes in you. And then I'm like, okay, well, one is for the camera and one is for the tool. What's the third one for? I thought, you know, like in film, we use a clapper, you know, that thing.
Yes.
I thought, why does my surgery have to be in sync?
That's funny. Yeah. We're doing a three-camera sitcom on your...
I still own the rights. I told you that at the beginning. So.
That's right. So, wow, that's pretty amazing that they were able to do that.
It was nothing short of a miracle, I have to say. I was very, very fortunate.
So how did you go from lung cancer survivor to author? I mean, did you just start writing down your thoughts as everything was happening?
Yes. Once I got my first diagnosis, and it really wasn't when I got my diagnosis, once Dr. Faust told me I might have cancer, I started to write down what was going on with me, because for some reason I felt it would be important not to forget.
Right, exactly.
I didn't know why. So I kept very detailed notes on everything that was going on, not only in physically, but psychologically, which I think is one of the most underexamined areas of...
Oh, yes, it is.
And in my wandering mind, you can only imagine how much stuff was going on. So I, you know, by the time I had that lung surgery, I had this probably 100 pages of notes that I'd written about what was going on. And then I put them away happily, and I thought, great, good riddance. I never want to see these things again. Because my doctor told me I had an indolent lymphoma. It was slow growing. Lucky for me, so I may have to deal with it again in my life, but it could be 20 years before anything happened. And then 6 months later, I went in for my checkup, and they found another tumor.
So it wasn't a slacker like you thought?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. And I was angry.
Right.
I was angry because I thought it was going to be 10 years before somebody told me I had another tumor. I was ready for that. I was not ready to have another tumor. So one of the biggest burdens that I had at that point was, now I have to tell everybody. And by then there were a lot of people, my friends, my family. I got to tell them, guess what? I have another tumor. I have to go in through all these tests. We don't know what the prognosis is, et cetera, et cetera. And the burden of that was just overwhelming. So I wrote an email to as many people as I thought needed to know. And I said, this email is to let you know that from now on, I will send you an email and keep you up to date on everything that's going on with me medically. So you don't have to feel like you have to call me, because I'm sure you can relate to this, Mel. Doesn't everybody call you on the day that you have your doctor's appointment?
Or the day that you're feeling the worst.
Yeah.
And the last person who calls you is like the one who just like gets you're like, I don't want to talk to you anymore. And they have no idea that 10 other people asked, how are you? The whole like, not like, how are you doing, but how are you feeling today?
How are you feeling? That's a question I would not mind never hearing for the rest of my life.
Well, and the other thing is like, I've actually like counseled some friends of mine who has a mutual friend who I didn't really know. I said, you know what? Only bring up cancer if she does. Only talk about it when she wants to. I mean, there were so many days when I'm sure you wanted to, Michael, that you wanted to hear about someone's like crappy day at work, or, you know, when they went out for margaritas or something, and not about like, so is your hair growing back yet? It's like,
oh yeah. Tell me about the holes in your socks.
Yes.
Take my mind off of this horror that I'm dealing with on a daily basis.
Exactly.
Distract me.
Yes.
So anyway, so the emails went out, and then I decided that was the way I would communicate. And then the strangest thing happened was, a few weeks after doing this, I got an email from someone I didn't know, a stranger.
Oh.
He said, you know, so-and-so, your friend, forwarded me these emails that you've been writing, and I don't know how to say this, but I'm really enjoying reading about your ordeal. And I hope you don't take this the wrong way, and I hope everything works out for you, but if you wouldn't mind, could you add me to the email list?
Oh.
So I did, and then I got another email from a stranger again saying, you know, obviously, hope everything works out, and when it does, you should do something with these emails. Because I was in the habit of writing everything in such detail. And I think people were just unaccustomed to that sort of, you know, hearing someone's first person account.
Yes.
As it was happening. So I turned it into a book.
Did you self-publish?
Yes. Okay. I decided to self-publish. I won't bore you with the story of how I actually had somebody who wanted to publish a book, but I'm really happy with the choice that I made.
So, you know, we were talking about your ass on the cover. Now it's funny. And I know a lot of cancer books, they just seem like they're written for like people who have had cancer survivors, cancer patients. Now, if I gave this book to a friend of mine who's never had cancer, but who knows what I've gone through, what would you think about that?
I think that would be great. I've done it myself.
Given your book to somebody? What? No. I mean, why would you think that it would be good for other people?
I tried never to forget that my job, when I decided to put on the hat that says author, I tried to never forget that my job is to entertain people, to engage them, and to tell a compelling story. So this story, even though it is ostensibly a story about a guy who had cancer and a guy who went through a divorce and a guy who lived through 9/11 and on and on and on, it's really kind of a story about me, this person who was just scared to death and had to find a way to go on with his life. And I think that anybody can relate to that.
Did you go through a divorce, 9/11, and cancer in the same year?
Yeah.
Did you like?
I had it, my calendar was empty, so.
Did you live near 9/11? Did you live near the World Trade Center?
I lived in an area called NoHo in Manhattan.
Okay.
It was close enough that for the next 4 months, we could smell the World Trade Center.
Oh, wow.
And it was a horrific smell.
Wow.
And of course, I went down there when it happened, and then I was there the next day, and we all lived it in a very intense way. And yeah, in my particular neighborhood. And of course, I knew people who were, you know, in those buildings, unfortunately.
Right. Wow.
Hmm.
That's not funny, but it kind of is if you think about like all those, you know, they say bad things happen in threes, so you're really set for the rest of your life, I think.
At least for that year.
At least for 2001, exactly. But my goodness.
Yeah. You know, it's funny I don't tend to think, oh, is this a sign of something? Although I have to say there were a few moments there where I was like, you know, they say, what's that expression about God never gives you more than you can handle? And I was like, get me God now.
Yeah.
And get on the phone. We have to talk.
You're like, this is supposed to be for somebody else, not for me.
Right.
Right. So with all this stuff, 9/11 and excuse me, your divorce, how do you feel that you made cancer funny in your book? Because I know how cancer and, you know, the ridiculous things that happen are funny to me. But how would you, give me a story, for example.
Okay. For example, when I was going in for my first surgery.
Yes.
I'm sure you'll recognize this feeling. I was in the pre-op room. I had my family around me. Mm-hmm. And then the guys came in with a gurney and they put me on the gurney and they laid me down flat and they started to wheel me to the operating room.
Yes.
And I had that point of view that you've seen on television so many times. Yes. Where you just those overhead lights one at a time. And I thought, wow, this is wild. I feel like I'm on a TV show. And then I looked up and there was the most beautiful woman I have ever seen in my life. She was one of the doctors or one of the residents. I couldn't figure out who she was. And I thought, oh my God, I can't just go into surgery. I got to find out who this woman is. I got to get her phone number. I got to say, listen, I know the circumstances are a little rough, but can we maybe afterwards get together and have a drink or something like that? And of course, I've got no sense that, first of all, I'm married at this point.
Right.
I'm wearing a shower cap and I've got to have the most ghostly complexion you can imagine. But in my mind, I'm sort of this attractive guy. And maybe she can see that. And then it dawns on me, wait a minute. Why am I seeing the most beautiful woman that I've ever seen right before I'm about to go into surgery that I should live through, but you never know? I thought, maybe this is what you see before you die. You know, people talk about, you know, you see a light at the end of the tunnel, or
right.
Maybe she's the angel that's going to escort me to heaven. And I started to panic. Stop this gurney. Don't let me in there. I've seen the angel. I'm not ready. And then, of course, luckily they had very strong drugs and knocked me out.
So who was she?
She was just one of the residence teams. And when I woke up, I saw her again. But something happened while I was unconscious. I think maybe my moral compass kicked in. And so I was just grateful to see her, grateful to be alive, and anxious to see my family again.
That must have been, was it kind of scary, and was it kind of like when you saw her again?
Well, I was pretty drugged up, and I do remember seeing her and going, oh yeah, it's the angel, and then thinking, oh wait a minute, my surgery's over. That's how I started to kind of piece together that my surgery was over, and I was up, and I obviously had survived it. So
here's what I'm thinking, since you're now single, right? You are single, right?
So, No. At that point?
Well, no, now.
No, now I'm married.
Oh, now you're married. Okay.
I'm remarried, yes.
Well, I was going to say, for single people, you know how they write with Sharpie, like, you know, this, when I had my breast surgery done, they put a little thing on there, whatever. You could probably write your phone number in Sharpie somewhere on you. So then you'd be like, you know, I'm available. Because that way the person will see all of you and then they can make that determination later.
Yes, I'm available, and I don't normally look like this.
Right. I'm not usually naked on a metal table, but maybe we could go for coffee in a couple days when I'm feeling a lot better.
Yeah, no, it's good to write. It's good to know. That's actually, I'm writing that suggestion down. I kind of like that.
Excellent, excellent.
You never know.
So it's just funny. Give me another story of something funny that happened to you.
Well, when I was seeing the lung specialist,
yes,
for the first time, I was terrified, of course, and I thought any minute he's going to tell me you're going to die. So he brought me into his office, and he had all these books stacked up and papers and files. And I mean, it was the messiest office I've ever seen, on the floor, on every shelf. And I thought, this nut job is the person that I'm going to find out if I'm going to live or die. Like, what am I doing in here? And then I saw he had a sign that said something like, I'm too busy to clean up. So I thought, okay, so he at least knows that this is a really messed up office,
right,
and that
right.
there should be, you know, someone should be in here, clean things. Because you just had the feeling that your record could be so easily misplaced. So he had one of those light boxes for looking at x-rays and CAT scans and stuff on his wall.
Right.
And he, you know, with the gravitas of a lung specialist, says, okay, Michael, now let's take a look at your CAT scan. And he takes it and he puts it up on this light box. And his fingers get like all fumbly, and he drops my CAT scan, and it goes right behind his desk. Oh. He has that desk that you've seen in a Coen Brothers movie. You know, the one that weighs like 4,000 pounds, and it's made of like the strongest oak that ever grew on the planet, and you can't possibly move it. It's probably bolted into the floor.
Yes.
We couldn't get the CAT scan out.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm trying to find out, am I going to die? And he's like, I can't tell you. I really need that CAT scan. So the two of us were trying to move this. It was just impossible to move. We pushed, we pulled. Finally, he called a maintenance guy, and we had to wait there for 15 minutes while my life is hanging in the balance. And this guy showed up with just a, you know, a torso the size of Cleveland. And lifted the desk up all by himself.
Oh my gosh.
And pulled out the CAT scan. And then, of course, I got the news that it's definitely a tumor and it's probably lymphoma.
You're like, are you sure that's mine? That someone else's didn't fall back there?
Let's put the desk back and maybe
yeah.
rearrange it or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
That's funny. Now you said you were thinking about making this into a movie. How is that going?
Very well. Yep. There's a lot of interest.
Excellent.
I got a phone call yesterday, as a matter of fact, about turning this into a movie. And I've also had interest from producers about turning this into a play, a stage play.
Very nice.
Yeah, both of which I think I'm going to do.
Now, would you do the one-man show?
It's good that you asked me that, because I was sort of asking myself that same question. I'm not, by nature, a performer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm used to being behind the camera. I'm not opposed to the idea of doing it, but I think there's a universal quality to my story that people can really relate to. So if I develop it, or I should say when I develop it, into a play, I'd like to develop it into something that other people can perform.
So you can judge them instead of other people judging you.
Exactly. I can say, it's not me, it's that guy. He's the guy. Believe me, that guy's married. He shouldn't be looking at that doctor.
I'm sorry. Now, would you have casting sessions where you have to look at someone's butt?
You know, I told you, the butt, I cannot believe the importance that this butt has assumed over time. But yeah, absolutely. Every detail matters, as they say.
So who would play you in the movie? If you just walked into, say, Paramount Pictures and they said, here you go, you could get any movie actor that you wanted to play you, who would it be? But withstanding. Like
the answer that every man wishes he could give is Brad Pitt,
right?
Russell Crowe, mm-hmm. somebody handsome and full of self-confidence. I think my character tends more towards the neurotic end. So I think more like a Paul Rudd,
mm-hmm.
Jesse Eisenberg, Woody Allen. Although, who wants to see Woody Allen in a movie anymore? No, I love Woody Allen.
Or in a hospital gown, for that matter.
Yes.
Richard Lewis.
Right there. Good. Sure. Sure.
Wow. See? And you could get just your, you know, introducing some new actress, and that could be her, like, it role.
You know? It could happen.
You could have Angelina Jolie as, you know, as the angel.
Angelina Jolie, right, as the angel. I'd rather have Angelina Jolie as the butt that we see, but.
There you go. Yeah. That would be awkward, though. That might be a whole other book if it's you.
Now it's not only funny, it's cute.
Exactly. Well, unbelievably, we're almost out of time, Michael. So I want you to tell me how people can find you on the internet, Facebook, and that kind of thing.
Okay. They can go to my website, which mm-hmm. is nowitsfunny.com. They can look me up on Facebook. My name is Michael Solomon. I don't have that's my name on Facebook. There's also a fan page for the book called Now It's Funny.
Are you on Twitter?
I am. @NowItsFunny.
Excellent. So they can find you and they can buy your book on any of those places?
They can buy the book, not on my Facebook page. I have to figure out how to do that. But they can buy the book on my website.
Excellent.
They can buy the book on Amazon. They can buy the book on Barnes & Noble, iTunes, Kobo.
Awesome.
Hmm.
So buy the book and read it before the movie comes out, because we'll see Angelina Jolie on the movie poster.
I like your idea, Mel. I have to say, as soon as we're done, I'm going to get on the phone and see if we can make that happen.
That would be awesome. I just want to just fly me out for the premiere. That's all I ask.
You got it. And I've now said that in front of an audience. You can take me to task.
Exactly. Well, hang on, Michael. I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. This is Mel Majoros. I am the Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. Become a fan of the show on Facebook, The Cancer Warrior, on EmpowerRadio.com. The Cancer Warrior is also available on iTunes and on the podcasts app on your iPhone. And check out my award-winning blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And as always, life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.